Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is Wayne Hoffman, author of Sweet Like Sugar, the book. Okay, here's what the book's about. Kurt Cobain, White Party, Orthodox rabbis, Jewish bookstores, and a strange relationship, a great relationship, though, between a young gay man and an older rabbi. Wayne, hello and welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Let me just read the audience the first sentence of the book, and you'll see how it just grabs you. I was looking at internet porn when the rabbi opened my door. He caught me there. I mean, you know how...
Oh, that was the idea.
So tell me how did this book come about? How does your writing come about? Sweet Like Sugar is fabulous, but
thank you.
Let me hear how did you come to write Sweet Like Sugar?
Well, I came to write Sweet Like Sugar. I mean, everyone who has written a book can tell you that the journey is incredibly long. I've been Jewish my whole life. I grew up in a traditional capital C conservative Jewish household. My brother's a rabbi, and I've been gay pretty much all that time too. And for the past quarter century, I'm 40, I've been figuring out how to be both gay and Jewish at the same time, which is not always an easy juggling act, though I think I do a pretty good job of it by now.
Mm-hmm.
But for the past 10 years, I've been working in Jewish nonprofits and Jewish media as an out gay man and seeing up close how different people within the Jewish community react to gay people around them, and that's something I wanted to put down on paper based on my own experiences of people around me, experiences in the community at large, and really put all that together. And what set it up for me, which is the opening scene that you're just reading, is one day several years ago, I was managing editor of The Forward, which is a Jewish weekly newspaper, and I had a couch in my office. And an editor from the Vorwärts, which is the Yiddish version of our newspaper, across the floor, came in with an old man behind him, and he asked if this old man could lie down on my couch because he was sick. And I said, yes. In comes this elderly Orthodox man on my couch, and he lay down and went to sleep. He was very, very ill. And I'm watching him sleep, wondering, what happens if he wakes up? What would we say to each other? What would our conversation be like? What could we talk about? Would we argue? Would we find something in common? Could we be friends? Would we have a contentious relationship? Would he storm out if he knew I was gay or a leftist or an atheist? What would he do? Does he even speak English? Who is he?
Mm-hmm.
That's what got me thinking, and that's what turned into the opening scene. In reality, what happened is the old man felt better, got up, and walked out of my office, and that was the end of that. But that's a very short book. So what it turned into in my novel is he wakes up and we start talking, and that goes on for a couple hundred pages. A relationship develops against all odds. It's not without difficulty. It has lots of difficulty. But a relationship develops. It happens. The two people speak.
Great. You know, my gay audience – we'll start to leer and say that there's some sort of a sexual thing going on with an older younger, which is
not.
What? Of course not. And how? And you really draw very strict boundaries, which is great. I love it. But this relationship, you know, is a wonderful. It talks back and forth. It's a lot of play back and forth with people that you wouldn't think had much play back and forth, that could argue, that could, this is my side of the story, this is the way it is, there's no other way.
Well, you know, this is the beauty of fiction. And first let me say, if you do want a book with an intergenerational sexual relationship, my first book, Hard, is all about that. And that's much more explicit, and the sex happens. That's not what this book's about. I've been a journalist for more than 22 years by now, and one of the reasons I turned to fiction, I'm still a journalist, but I turned to fiction within the past decade because there are real-life issues that you can't always get at in journalism. And one of the things you can do in fiction is take two very different people and make them meet. You can put them in the same room. You can force them to have a conversation and find out what it would sound like. And that's what I could do in a novel. I mean, I could have waited around 1,000 years until an Orthodox rabbi and a young gay man really became friends and reported back to me how it went. But here I could actually create people and put them in a room and say, go, and just watch what happens.
Yeah, just kind of like Latter Days, you know, you wouldn't, where you get a party boy, and that's a great thing. The other thing that reminded me of your book when I, you know, that got the Zuckerman Sweet Like Sugar is, I don't know if you're familiar with the, I think it's Evan Fallenberg's book, Light Fell.
Yes, absolutely.
And the man's name is Joseph Licht, so it's kind of a play, same play on words, but completely different book. Trust me. You talk a lot of the book has a lot. The word beshert, which of course means fate, or it was written, or whatever. Talk to us a little bit about how fate enters into the storyline.
Well, you know, beshert is a Yiddish word, a Yiddish term, and it really has two related, very similar meanings. One of them is, like you say, is fate. It was meant to be. It was kismet. It was supposed to happen this way. It was predetermined. The other is a related word, which is if you say someone is your beshert or is my beshert, it's the person I was meant to spend my life with, which is a common idea in certain Jewish circles that there's, you know, there's a Mr. Right or a Mrs. Right out there for you, and that's the person you're meant to be with. What I wanted to do here is to take that idea and actually run with it and see if I could expand its meaning and say, well, maybe there is something to fate. Maybe there are people we are destined to meet, but not necessarily romantically or sexually, but maybe there are people we are destined to meet in life because we can learn something essential from them about humanity, about ourselves, and there's something we can teach them that no one else can teach them. Maybe there's someone we are destined to meet, not as a lover, but just to meet. And also, maybe there's more than one. Maybe there are many people we are destined to meet, and that there's a reason for it. So to take a very traditional and romantic Jewish notion of beshert and sort of explode it into a modern context and say, no, I'm not going to say there's no such thing as fate. I'm going to say you were thinking too narrowly, and actually let's take it and expand it and make it bigger.
Right. And in this case, not just a teacher, but the student teaching the teacher – and meeting people randomly that aren't, of course, not random, and just making a beautiful fabric of a story. I want to remind our listeners that there is a call-in to speak with either myself or Wayne Hoffman, author of Sweet Like Sugar. The phone number is 805-830-8355. Okay, back to fate and religion. Okay. The as far as the rabbi goes, you know, and the young gay man, you're talking about two people from two different communities, and you paint beautiful pictures of the Washington D.C. gay community, and also I think it's Glenbrook.
Glenbrook, yes, outside Washington D.C. It's an imaginary place, but it's the suburb of Maryland.
I couldn't find it either, so I thought the imaginary Orthodox community with people pushing baby carriages and wearing the long skirts and the whole shtick. Two completely different communities, but both of them paradoxes. And can you talk a little bit about how what are the paradoxes of both communities?
Well, I'll tell you how I came to create this fictional place, because it's not like I created it out of thin air. I grew up in suburban Maryland, near several of these suburban Orthodox communities. One of them in particular is called Kent Mill. If you are Orthodox, no matter where you're from in this country, when I say Kent Mill, you will nod because you already know where it is.
I nodded,
If you are not Orthodox and you're not from right there, you'll have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, because Kent Mill isn't even a town. It's not even on maps.
The neighborhood.
It's that distinct to Orthodox people anywhere that it's instantly recognizable. I grew up a mile away from it. I could have walked to Kent Mill from where I was. And I wanted to set the book there because it is an Orthodox neighborhood that's kind of invisible and permeable. It's not a ghetto. It's not exclusively Orthodox at all. And in fact, non-Orthodox people don't even know it's an Orthodox neighborhood, and I can prove it.
Right.
When I set the book there, I was talking to friends I went to high school with, also walking distance from Kent Mill. And these were friends who are not Jewish, but they're certainly aware of the Jewish community. They were my friends.
Right.
And I I told them I wanted to set it in a community much like Kent Mill because it was a suburban Orthodox community. And every one of them said to me, what are you talking about? Kent Mill's an Orthodox community? They hadn't even noticed. They'd been there 1,000 times and they'd never noticed. So I wanted an Orthodox zone that a non-Orthodox person might actually enter.
Mm-hmm.
And being outside Washington, D.C., also a place where it would actually be possible that an Orthodox person and a gay person would both be.
That's true, yeah.
There aren't that many. It's not like if I said, if you're from New York, that you were in Curious Joel, and there's no reason if you weren't Orthodox you would ever be in Curious Joel.
Right, right.
One of the other places that comes up in the book that's similar is actually a whole chapter set in South Florida,
where
the fact that South Beach is right next to North Beach, that you have a gay neighborhood right next to an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood, those are not the same neighborhood. They're actually extremely different, but they are adjacent to each other.
Right.
Is another instance where you, if you're on the right street around Lincoln Road Mall in Miami Beach, you might actually see both Orthodox people and gay men in the same neighborhood.
That's correct. Right. It's true, and there's a funny dichotomy about it because at one time they were both discriminated against terribly in this country.
That's right.
And they both have come to terms and made their own rules. And you know, the gay community has rules, and you know, you spoke about those. You know, the perfect dresser, the perfect bodies, the perfect and you also talked about you know, the Orthodox people, the people who observe most of the rules, all the rules. The rabbi who never you know, rode in a car when he was sick and always walked a shul, and you know, would only eat kosher food. And so it even though they're completely different rules, there are rules, you know. And
part of the point of the rules in both cases is it's not just – part of it is that there's a set of standards. That's undeniable. But the other part is that there are rules more than anyone can possibly follow so that other people can tell you you're doing it wrong. No matter what you do, you're doing it wrong, or you're not doing enough. You go to synagogue, you don't go often enough. You go to synagogue often enough, it's the wrong synagogue.
Right.
You go, or you're gay, you go to a gym, it's not the right gym.
Right.
You have big biceps, they're not big enough. There's always something someone else can tell you that I can't believe that you think that's sufficient. It's not nearly sufficient. It counts for nothing. Your efforts are insufficient.
Right. That's the paradox, is that both communities are so different, yet so the same. That you have you have the same, you know, the same people looking down at you. You know, two people telling a third person how to live is the rule of a gay community, and it's also the rule of an Orthodox community, which I grew up in, and now I live in a gay ghetto in Fort Lauderdale, which on the edges of this gay ghetto, people don't know it's a gay ghetto. I mean, right in the middle of the street, there's the rainbow flags and stuff like that, but of course it's expanded, and people live on the outskirts and things like that. And, you know, every so often I'll have a person ask me what little stickers are on my car, or, you know, what's going on here. And I explain to them, you know, that I'm gay, and they look at me and they go, "We don't look gay." I said, what does gay look like?
What does that mean?
Know? Yeah, I know. Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, but you know, I'm 62. I'm 62, so I'm not in the mix, as they say. But you know, it's kind of funny that you know, coming from both communities, I've lived in the Orthodox community of yeshiva, dropped out, but my brothers are observant. Very 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 unusual. You know, but very now it's taken about 15 years. Everybody's accepted me. I have a partner. They've all met. My partner has met all 169 of my living relatives.
Wow.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting journey that I've had, but I'm not writing a book. That's too much. All right. Okay. I have some great quotes I want to talk to you about. One of them is how you really loved Judaism in like second, third grade, and that's when I loved it too. I was like I loved all the stories. I loved all the people. I loved all the characters. I loved the holidays. And then they ruined it.
That sadly is often the case. You know, there's something marvelous about Jewish storytelling and parables and Bible stories, and not just Bible stories, also the way rabbis shape their sermons, the way Shalom Aleichem could tell a story. There are lots of wonderful ways of telling a story when you're Jewish, some of them true, some of them not true, some of them somewhere in between. I put rabbi sermons and Shalom Aleichem in that category.
Good.
Sort of exaggerated hyper-truth. But there comes a point all too often, I think, in Hebrew school, and I can speak for conservative synagogues where I grew up, where the focus comes so strongly on the negatives, on discrimination, on
right.
persecution, on the Holocaust. These are all important things. They're all things that should be taught. They're all essential.
Right.
But it becomes the dominant narrative and tends to crowd out the real joy of
right.
of Judaism, of Jewish culture. And at the same time, there comes the, once you're old enough, the sort of crushing sense of rules, and judgment from the higher-ups.
Mm-hmm.
You go to synagogue, and it's wonderful to see you. It's why don't you come more often?
Right.
It's always the judgment and the negativity sort
right.
of tend to creep in and crowd out the really wonderful, joyous stuff we got as kids,
right.
which is unfortunate. It's really unfortunate because there's a lot of wonderful stuff
oh, yeah.
to hold on to. If
right,
you can
right.
get past that.
Right, exactly. And the rules, and you can't do this on this day, and you can't cut your hair till in the summer, and the kosher rules and the walking rules, and you really feel like you're climbing up a wax hill and slipping. It's a slippery, no matter what you do, it's not enough. And that's
you know,
the way I felt.
In the book, the rabbi tries to no one takes anything lying down in Sweet Like Sugar.
Well,
people they let each other have it.
Yep.
At one point, Benji, the main character, is telling the rabbi basically this. There are too many rules. Everything is about what you can and can't do. And the rabbi turns it around and says, you see rules and I see opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you can't drive a car on Shabbat. It's that if you do observe the Sabbath, you have this wonderful day of rest to get in touch with your spiritual side or your community or your family or God, whatever you want to say. That there are opportunities, that these rules are not about restricting you, they're actually about opening up new avenues, which I don't necessarily agree with, but that's the rabbi's point of view here. And the trick is that Benji's never heard anyone explain it that way before.
Right.
So when I talk about judgments and rules, I'm not saying that the rules in themselves are inherently bad or negative, but the
mm-hmm.
way they're presented is always punitive and negative.
Correct.
That you have to do this. Why? Because you can't do this.
Right, because it's a sin.
Right.
Let me just break away from Sweet Like Sugar and talk about a personal appearance that Wayne Hoffman is going to be doing for the Stonewall National Museum and Archives. I'm also in charge of the book readings, book signings, and distinguished author series there. And Wayne is going to be our guest in live, in person, on Saturday, December 10th at 1 p.m., we're at 1300 East Sunrise Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale, and I'll repeat that later in the show and also put it up on the blog. But, you know, if you want to meet Wayne in person, have some I bake cookies. They're not kosher. But some of the gay guys can walk because it's in Victoria Park. So if somebody wants to walk, they can. If they can ride their bike, they can. We have a big parking lot. It's 1300 East Sunrise Boulevard, the Stonewall National Museum and Archives. There, my plug is over. Okay, back to in fact, there was a great quote where Benji asked the rabbi, you know, you've never broken Shabbat, and the rabbi says no. And then the rabbi says, you ask why I've never broken Shabbat. I ask why you've never kept it.
Right.
And
he's turned it around on Benji. And that's, you know, one of the things that people usually say when they hear about the book, they say, but those people couldn't actually ever have a conversation. And I say, no, actually they could.
Yeah.
And the point is not that this is an argument that one of them is going to win.
Right.
And the point is also not that one of them is going to change his mind. That Benji
right.
If you think Benji's going to wind up Orthodox at the end, he's not. And if you think
no.
the rabbi is going to go to a gay pride parade in the end, he's not. That's
mm-hmm.
not what happens. That doesn't ring true at all. The idea is that each of them challenges the other with questions that at least make them think about why they believe the things they do
mm-hmm.
and also open themselves up to making personal connections despite their abstract political and religious convictions to say,
mm-hmm.
Well, maybe I haven't changed my mind, but I don't know everything. So the rabbi is never going to come around to sort of celebrating gay life.
Right.
But he hopefully will come around to accepting the fact that even though this young guy who he's befriended is gay, that he's still part of his community and he's still what we would call a mensch. He's a wonderful guy.
Right.
And a wonderful friend to this old man who no one else seems to like.
Yes, yeah, that was the other thing, is that the relationship is, it starts out, you know, just letting him lay on the couch, driving him home from work, bringing his mail, and then it goes into a much, he starts to really want to know about the rabbi's life, and the rabbi wants to know about
his life. The rabbi's a nice guy, because he's not a nice guy.
He's a grumpy old man.
He's a really grumpy, bitter, with good cause, but he's not nice.
No, he's never nice. And you almost said if he was, it would have been too much of a... That I wouldn't have believed. I believe
no,
him.
No, I wouldn't either.
You want the rabbi to be this grumpy Ed Asner. Ed Asner will play this part,
yeah,
by the way. You
know, that would be wonderful.
That would be like the perfect person. Some crusty but benign. Anyway, forget it. There are other Beshert things in the book, or things that are fate, or things that are the promise. Of course, we find out the rabbi has a relationship with another woman before and even after he was married, not a sexual
right.
relationship, but a relationship. And Benji finds out about it by fate at White Party.
Perhaps.
How's that for a coincidence?
Benji finds out that the rabbi is not exactly the saint he seems to be as a very pious man. And if you're wondering if there's something horribly scandalous, then
no.
The rabbi's not an adulterer, he wasn't cheating on his wife, there's nothing like that. But it doesn't really matter. The rabbi had things in his past that he was not proud of about his own romantic life. And
mm-hmm.
no one could understand that really except Benji, this gay guy who he's befriended, who finally there's someone who might get it. And
right.
Benji does discover the rabbi's secret. It's unclear whether it was Beshert that Benji find out about this, or whether the rabbi actually intended to make him find out and sort of force the issue out into the open for the first time. It's never
right.
clear whether
right.
which one
right.
happened.
Well, even the woman says, I had not heard from him until he sent you here.
Exactly.
So, right, but the whole thing of her living in the same you know area with the rabbi kind of made it that was the Beshert part, I thought.
That was the yes, that she wound up after a 60-year hiatus in a relationship, she found him again,
right,
and sort of tried to pick up where they'd left off.
Yeah, that could only happen.
Yeah, that's Beshert. That's
yeah.
Beshert.
Anyway, again, the call-in number is 805-830-8355. There's a wonderful quote in there that the rabbi, when this is after an argument and after a cooling off period, the rabbi starts to move away from scripture and into interpretation and goes to Hillel and tells him to not walk away from his Judaism, that nobody can tell you how to practice Judaism, that it is your own personal choice. That to me was a huge breakthrough with the communication with these two people. I do think the rabbi actually moved more towards Benji than Benji moved towards the rabbi. That was my personal opinion. That sentence said it to me.
What the rabbi has done by this point is, again, without changing where he stands, has realized or accepted the fact that there are other people who don't stand where he stands who are still in a valid place. So he actually doesn't move.
Okay.
What he does is sort of open up what he's open to without moving himself.
Mm-hmm.
He never gives up orthodoxy. He never gives up being observant. But he comes to accept that other people who don't observe what he observes or think the way he thinks are still valid. And he can at least accept them for where they are and even ask them, why is that where you are? Explain it to me. And they don't
right.
have to persuade him. He just wants to know.
Correct.
Why is
Correct.
That? Because it's not only Benji who is not in the same place he is. The woman in the rabbi's life, the one who he was fated to be
right.
with, she's not Orthodox either.
Correct. Correct.
She's
yeah.
not where he is.
No.
And
no.
the rabbi lives in this Orthodox neighborhood, but as I mentioned, it's not an exclusively Orthodox neighborhood. He
right.
has neighbors who are not Jewish at all. And mm-hmm. Benji is kind of surprised one day when he's over, it's Halloween, and the rabbi has candy.
Candy, right.
He gave out to kids, and Benji says, I thought that Jews, meaning Orthodox Jews, didn't celebrate Halloween. And the rabbi says, I don't, but, you know, if my neighbor's child comes to me, what am I supposed to do, turn him away and not give him candy? Giving a child candy for Halloween is not the same as joining his church.
Right, like, right.
This is America. We all have neighbors. This is no big deal.
Correct.
It's not my holiday, but this is not a sin to give my neighbor's child a sour ball. And that's when the rabbi starts to realize that even in his own observance, he also has – there are openings.
Right.
If only he would notice that they're there. He already has some.
Right, but he's already – but he didn't notice them. You're right. I think
he didn't notice
Benji,
them.
And Benji brought that to life. He really did bring that to life. It is true. And I wish this rabbi could train some of the Orthodox Jews that were protesting gay marriage out in public, which doesn't affect them at all because it's the secular world.
And that would be lovely.
Well, I mean, as someone who was – I was raised in the white shirt tzitzit school, and I did remember a few things. In fact, I've tried to forget most of them. But one of the things I remembered was the two worlds, that the secular world and the Orthodox world were two different worlds, and it doesn't matter. I mean, why aren't these rabbis out protesting Red Lobster, you know, or Walmart for selling cloth with two kinds of material?
Right.
You know, the secular world is always to remain, and this is in the Torah, this is in the teachings, the Talmud, everywhere, that you leave the secular world alone, that, you know, the sacred and the profane. That's a major theme in Judaism, that these wingnuts have – I mean, you know, they're probably my relatives if I went back and looked at the genealogy. These wingnuts just don't get, you know, that they're – it doesn't affect them, you know. You know,
This is one of the points where any kind of personal connection can make a huge difference.
Exactly.
And I'll give you an example. Rosh Hashanah dinner – I was over at my brother's house. My brother's a rabbi, conservative rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in New York, and New York just passed same-sex marriage this year. And there was an older couple, a straight couple, who were there, and they were talking about how they were not happy that New York had passed same-sex marriage. They're saying this in front of me and my husband, who I've known them for years. Well, they're not happy that they're same-sex marriage, and I was arguing with them. And the wife said, well, what does it even matter to you? It's not like you're married, because I haven't seen them in a couple years. What does it matter? It's not like you're married. I said, actually, we did get married this year. And she said, oh, Mazel Tov, tell me all about it. Immediately, within a half a second, the abstract political argument, I'm against same-sex marriage because my rabbi told me I should be, or that's what I always heard, turned into, oh, you're married, but you did get married. How wonderful.
Right.
You had a wedding. What was it like?
Right.
Immediately, instantly, because she knew me.
Right. Well, the same thing happened in my own personal opinion. I've been in relationships before. Recently, the last 9 years, I've been with a lovely gentleman. People that know me, he's Dr. Grover Lawless. He's a well-known psychiatrist in the gay community. Converted to Judaism. Actually did a conservative conversion and learned Torah and trope and did a bar mitzvah from scratch with the whole shtick, with the whole Haftorah and the speech.
Wow.
And some of my ultra-Orthodox family flew in for the bar mitzvah.
Wow.
Which people I don't speak to, that I used to argue with about being gay, once my partner, who we are legally married, became bar mitzvah, it was like, oh, mishpacha, we got to go. And it was the same thing. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. They called me and said, "Can we come to the bar mitzvah?" Because they were coming to Miami anyway. So anyway, we're down to the last 1 minute. I told you it'd be the fastest 30 minutes of our lives. Wow, this is great. I can't wait to meet you next week. What's your closing? Let's say I'm a young writer. What's the advice you would give a young writer today?
About if someone wants to write a novel?
Yes.
The advice I would give you is twofold. One, keep at it.
Uh-huh.
Keep at it. It's worth it. But the second thing I would tell you, and this is urgent, is it is not quick. And if you think it's quick, you're doing it wrong. If you think you wrote a novel in a month, you didn't. If you think you wrote a novel in 3 months, you didn't.
Uh-huh.
You have years ahead of you. I guarantee it. There's no other way to do it.
Okay. That's great. It's time to sign off. Remember, December 10th, you can meet Wayne Hoffman live at the Stonewall Library, and good night from Fort Lauderdale.
Boing.